Welcome to America's Cannabis Conversation. Heard every Saturday at 4:20 p.m. online at americascannabisconversation.com. Each week, we provide our listeners information, education, and insight into the exploding medical and adult-use cannabis industry. You'll hear from industry experts, elected officials, local growers, detractors, and more. Learn how to build your own cannabis business, how to grow the product, what's legal, and where it's legal. Tune in each week to hear the latest industry news and updates from the American Cannabis Industry Association in Washington, tips on investing in cannabis, personal success stories, and more. It's time to join the conversation. And here's your host, Dan Perkins.
This is Dan Perkins here with your America's Cannabis Conversation quick news. Los Angeles, California, multi-state cannabis operator MedMen's Breyerman steps down as CEO, gives up voting control of the company. Adam Breyerman, the flamboyant co-founder and once high-flying cannabis retailer MedMen Enterprises, resigned as the chief executive and surrendered his voting control. The resignation, effective February 1st, comes at a time that the Los Angeles-based company has laid off hundreds of employees, sold non-core assets, and has been beset by questions about its financial health. In the most recent worrisome turn of events for shareholders and a sign of possible cash crunch, MedMen asked vendors to consider taking equity payments. Further to the story, MedMen said co-founder Andrew Modin also agreed to give up his super voting shares by December 2020. Cannabis executives, professionals, and financiers can expect 2020 and the rest of the new decade to have at least as much impact on their business as any other year in the past 10. New legal recreational and medical cannabis states have come online, or are poised to, in Illinois and Michigan, as well as unexpected markets such as Missouri and Arkansas. And then there's a real prospect in 2020 for voters or lawmakers in the Northeast states such as New Jersey, New York, Pennsylvania, and Rhode Island will approve recreational markets. Growth in the cannabis space will not be limited to the United States in 2020, however. Mexico is making huge strides in recreational cannabis legalization, and medical marijuana markets are gaining momentum overseas in Australia to Italy. Even more countries appear to be moving towards legalization or adult use of cannabis. In our last story, we go to New Orleans, Louisiana. Southern University becomes the first historic black college to enter in the CBD industry. The school announced a new anti-inflammatory product line, Lyria Holistic Healthcare, at New Orleans H&W Drugstore Dispensary. Southern is one of the only two permit holders in the state's medical marijuana system, along with Louisiana State University. Our goal with this line is to support all communities by creating access to wellness products at affordable prices. Dr. Chandri Marsharis, CEO of Illyria, no one should endure the stress of trying to balance a healthy lifestyle at a high cost. That within itself is unhealthy. And that's your America's Cannabis Conversation. Quick news. I'm Dan Perkins. We have guests joining the conversation today. John Mulak, who will speak with us about the process of growing cannabis and hemp to protect the environment. Next, for those of you that are thinking about buying or starting a cannabis business, Nick Richards, an attorney, will discuss with us 280E requirements, which say that individual businesses cannot deduct the cost of doing business against their cannabis income except for about 50% of the cost of the product. Justin Costello, the founder and CEO of GRN Funds and Holdings, is going to launch his drones delivery service soon. He's going to talk to us about why he decided to use drones and how you can improve your profitability if you use drones for delivery. And finally, we'll be talking to Morgan Fox of the National Cannabis Industry Association about what's happening in Washington, D.C. on deregulation. So let's start this conversation rolling. I'm Dan Perkins, and now back to the show. Welcome to America's Cannabis Conversation, and with us today is a really special guest,
John Rulak, who is a 20-year veteran in the hemp and superfood industry, and he's founder of Reeve Botanicals and Nativa, which he founded, and he is the chief hemp officer. They're taking a different approach of growing hemp, and I think it's important because there's a lot of discussion about both hemp and cannabis, about the quality of the product, the ingredients that are used to grow it, and how much is retained in the plants. So as an organic hemp grower, John's going to tell us why he decided to do that. So, John, welcome to the program.
Thank you for inviting me, Dan. Appreciate being on the show today.
What made you decide to want to go to organic hemp?
It reminds me of a T-shirt that says, "Don't panic, go organic." And really, I've been an advocate and a fan of organic. You know, there's a great quote, Franklin Roosevelt says, "The nation that destroys its soils destroys itself." And many civilizations have done that in the past. And we have 60 harvests left. And that was from a few years ago. So we're how we treat the soil has a big impact, whether the food we grow or the medicine that we grow. So that's one of the reasons why I'm focused on healthy soils, and healthy soils lead to healthy plants, which lead to healthy people, healthy climate, healthy oceans.
Well, John, I have an internist, cardiologist, who I work with, and he told me a number of years ago that he's very much into nutrition and organic, and he's saying that at different areas of the world, you have different qualities of soil. And he said that there are many countries outside the United States who have a better quality of soil than we have in the United States, because we've put so many chemicals and pesticides and everything else in it. We can grow, but the food generative value is continuing to decline. How does that fit in your organic opportunity?
Yeah. Well, I think if you go back, I remember reading a quote from the U.S. Secretary of Agriculture in 1938 and said that we face a crisis in America today, and that was in 1938, about how we've destroyed our soils and how much minerals were missing from the soil. That was 1938. Mm. Here we are in 2020. 90% of Americans are short in the really important minerals such as magnesium, zinc, and iron. And so I'm a advocate of organic and regenerative agriculture, and organic for hemp is important in cannabis. Hemp, like corn, likes nitrogen. The way that they use it in the modern era is through a German process that split natural gas through a chemical process and turn it into a nitrogen gas. Then you apply to the soil. The challenge is when you put that chemical onto the soil, when it rains, that rain washes down, you know, into the creek. And where does the creek flow to? The river. And where does the river flow to? To the ocean. And we have in this Gulf of Mexico, from all of this chemical runoff, much of it corn and soy, you know, chemicals, wheat, but also now hemp. As hemp starts to expand across the United States, we have a 500-mile dead zone where there's not a fish, nothing living in that area, 500 miles, square mile in the Gulf of Mexico. Whereas in organic and regenerative practices, we do it a little differently. So I know we're going to talk a little more about that. And also another benefit for hemp is hemp is a bioaccumulator. What does that mean? It means that chemicals, pesticides, herbicides that are in the soil get absorbed up through the root and into the flower and the seed. So that's why it's important to choose certified organic. And my company that I founded, Reeve Botanicals, which stands for Regenerative Botanicals, was the first national brand to obtain the USDA, you know, seal, certified organic, a little over a year ago in 2019. So, organic's important.
So for the people like myself who don't know what regenerative means, take a moment and tell us about what that means as far as how you grow your plant.
I'd like just to kind of step away, look at it kind of as a general thing. You could think of three phases in agriculture. As we kind of industrialize using more chemicals, and we call that degenerative. So you're degenerating the soils, you're reducing the soil quality. We've lost over half of our soils in the U.S. So degenerating our soils, using, you know, contaminating our groundwater, reducing, you know, bees and butterflies, which over 70% of winged insects has disappeared in the last 75 years. I mean, in the last 40 years, since the 1970s, we've lost 70% of moths and butterflies, et cetera. And then in the 1980s, people came up with, how about if we could go to sustainable agriculture? So let's sustain the resources. But if you've already lost half of your topsoil and you've kind of degraded situation, sustainable really isn't enough. And this new word, regenerative, to like regenerate, and it restores the soil so we can actually increase the soil quality by working with plants and animals in a holistic way and kind of mimicking nature. Regenerative agriculture is becoming more popular. General Mills just recently announced that they're working to have 1 million acres using regenerative agriculture practices. A simple way to think about it is that regenerative agriculture runs off today's sunlight. So for instance, for hemp, instead of using yesterday's sunlight, which is petrochemicals, we use today's sunlight. So we grow plants that fix nitrogen instead of, so our factory is a field of alfalfa or vetch or cowpeas versus a petrochemical refining facility, which is how most corn and also cannabis. A lot of these major greenhouses, they're just using synthetic fertilizers. So ironically, people are turning to a plant as a medicine to heal themselves, but in supporting a way of growing it that is doing the opposite to the planet, actually helping to destroy the planet. So my wacky idea is, can we use hemp, this resurgence of hemp CBD, as a teaching moment to not only regenerate our own health through the benefits of what hemp has to offer, but also to regenerate and help heal the earth, which needs it rapidly now, given the challenge, environmental crisis and climate change crisis that we face.
We're speaking with John Rulak, who is the founder and chief hemp officer for ReBotanicals. From a consumer standpoint, if I take a hemp plant that's grown in a greenhouse indoors and a hemp grown in your facilities, is there a material difference between the quality of the product coming out to the ultimate consumer?
We think if you grow a crop in living soils, that there's going to be there's a different, you're not only voting for the health of the planet, but also you're much less likely to have any pesticides or herbicides that could show up in the crop, we actually test for glyphosate. We're one of the few brands, and it's in most soils. So like if, for instance, they don't really use much Roundup usually to spray the crop of hemp, but the if they grow it on a corn crop, a non-organic, they grow corn the previous season, they spray a lot of pesticides and herbicides like Roundup, and then they grow hemp the next season. Do you really want to concentrate your medicine, that flower, from a crop that was grown in those kind of soils? So we actually test for that, and most brands don't test for glyphosate. Just a few do, which is made by Monsanto. So there's some assurances in that way.
So what you're doing is the product that you produce, which is certified organic, doesn't have all those nasty things in them that perhaps somebody else growing hemp in a greenhouse or in a field that it was corn the previous year, you're not taking in those potentially bad chemicals, which could maybe, in some degree, defeat the use of the of what you're trying to do.
Yeah.
Is that true?
And if, I mean, there could be some in there for some people, and some cases maybe it doesn't show up. But ultimately, those chemicals that were used are going to end up in the air and our water. Roundup is in our, it's in our rainwater now. It's in mother's breast milk. It's in the umbilical cord for the newborn baby now, these synthetic chemicals. Whether it shows up in the hemp or not, which is a concern, but it's just the idea is how do we create an agriculture that's healthier for the land and healthier for the people and healthier for biodiversity? And I think that's an important thing.
I agree. So we've been speaking with John Rulak of eBotanicals. John, how do people get in touch with you? How do they buy your products? Where do they go?
One is they can go to our website, botanicals.com. We have tinctures, which are as a dietary supplement. You put it under your tongue and let it absorb, and we can get into a little about how the products. We also have topicals. Chains, Earth Fair has some of our products. And then Sprouts has our topical products. Some of the Safeways have them. But because of the recent confusion with FDA statements saying that CBD, you know, shouldn't be sold on the marketplace, the USDA says it's fine to sell. Congress says fine to sell. The FDA is saying other things. Are not all of our products are available at stores. Also, Natural Food Stores has them. So the website's a good place to find it.
We've been speaking with John Rulak, who is the founder and chief hemp officer for RE Botanicals. John, thank you for joining us today, and we're going to have you back real soon.
You're listening to America's Cannabis Conversation on the W420 Radio Network.
This is Dan Perkins, host of America's Cannabis Conversation, and I want to hear from you. Send me an email. Tell me what you like about our show, what you don't like about our show, what kind of guests you'd like to hear from, and are there subjects that are important to you that we're not discussing? Let us know. Go to W420RadioNetwork.com and send us an email. Thanks for listening.
Welcome back to The Conversation, and today we're joined with an exceptional guest, Nick Richards, who is an attorney, former IRS trial attorney, and with the firm out of Denver, I believe, is Greenspan Martyr. Nick, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Dan.
What's important that we want to talk about first in this segment is we want to talk about an incredible piece of law that I still can't believe happens, but if you're thinking about, and this is for people who are thinking about getting into the cannabis-related businesses, and Nick, you correct me if I'm wrong, but there's a Section 280E under the tax code that does not permit cannabis-related businesses from deducting their operating expense from gross revenue, I think with one exception, and that's about 50% of the value of the pure product. Did I get that right?
So it prevents them from taking their normal business deductions except for cost of goods sold, which cost of goods sold in a simple example is what you pay if you were a marijuana store, what you paid for the marijuana, you'd be able to deduct that, but not anything else. You can deduct all of it, correct.
Okay, because I already learned something. I was told that you could only deduct 50%. Not that that's not important, but getting to deduct all of it, the cost of goods sold, that's still important. So
that is important. And Dan, let me say this. Different types of businesses have different levels of cost of goods sold. So for a store, that cost of goods sold portion of their overall expenses is quite small, probably something like 30% of their overall expenses. But for a producer, so that's a cultivator or a manufacturer, the guys who make the vape pens and stuff, those folks, their cost of goods sold is really high, say 90% of their overall expenses. So Section 280E affects the industry differently depending on where you are in the industry.
When you and I had a conversation last week getting ready for the show, as always happens to me, after I hang up with a guest, I always think of something I wanted to ask him. So I'm not trying to put you on the spot. I just remembered this. If I look at the business and I listen to what you just said, did we talk about how if you have a vertically integrated company where you have a dispensary and then you may have a processing and a grow farm, and all these businesses are treated differently, or are they all taxed the same way?
They're all taxed under the same Internal Revenue Code, but they end up being 280E ends up being different in each of those three separate components. If you're truly vertically integrated and you have all three under one roof, then you know that it applies to cost of goods sold and everything but cost of goods sold. And basically, let's say you are vertically integrated and you are growing, processing, and selling it yourself. Basically, cost of goods sold in that model would be all your expenses up to final packaging ready for retail sales. So, and then if you broke those three different businesses up and took them out of one roof and put them each under a different roof, right, you could see cultivation, a lot of cost of goods sold, not a big 280E impact. Manufacturing, a lot of cost of goods sold, not a very big 280E impact. Dispensary, small cost of goods sold, big 280E impact.
I want to move away from the vertically integrated model to something that I've been looking for somebody like you to ask, and I'm not trying to put you on the spot. I'm just curious, when a much larger company that has nothing to do with cannabis acquires a cannabis company, what happens to them in that situation? Do they mm-hmm. file separate returns for the cannabis business, or is there a spillover effect that might affect the business? What happens there?
There's kind of two things that generally you look at when you're thinking about that as far as 280E goes. The first is the effect of 280E itself. And what 280E does is it creates phantom income. In our model, if you can't deduct your expenses, you have to pay tax on them, but you don't have that money anymore. You spent it. So it mm-hmm. creates phantom income. That's one thing that a big business would be concerned about is, can we handle this phantom income or not? How do we manage that? What's the proper way to lock that down, I like to say, and then control it. The other part is audits. Cannabis companies get audited. And so if you are the owner of a cannabis company, whether you're a company that owns that cannabis company or an individual that owns that cannabis company, depending upon the type of entity that you own it through, you get audited as well. And so if that cannabis company gets audited, they just follow it up the chain and they audit everything that's up the chain as well. And there are some things you can do to stop that a bit, but that is the other big concern of a cannabis company owner.
I was thinking about like a large multinational company like Coca-Cola or mm-hmm. Altria mm-hmm. that took an investment in vape and they bought millions of acres of growing fields. Does that have, I saw where Altria wrote down something like 40% of their investment in the vape operation. Does having a diversified company, and I want to say this the right way, does making the decision to go into a cannabis company at the moment put anything in your other companies at jeopardy?
I hear what you're saying. Can you jeopardize your overall company because of the ownership of a cannabis company? And I think I haven't seen that happen, but I think the risk is there. And because of that, the thing that I like to suggest is if you're an individual or a company that has exposure like that, that you own, that cannabis company that you own is a C corporation. And a mm-hmm. C corporation, differently from an S corporation or an LLC taxed as a partnership, C corporation is its own tax-paying entity. And mm-hmm. so things don't flow out of a C corporation like they do out of what I call a flow-through, because it pays its own taxes differently in an S-Corp or an LLC. The taxes are reported on the owner's tax return. And so if that's a cannabis company and those taxes are reported on the owner's tax return, well, now you're in the business, right? So mm-hmm. that is one thing that you use to protect owners from the the potential fallout of owning a cannabis company is a C corporation. And things got better with the change in the tax code 2 years ago, lowering the tax rate to 21% for a C corporation. Now that isn't such a big tax burden because C corporations, as I'm sure your viewers know, are legendary double taxed entities. Mm-hmm. What that basically means is that they pay tax on their dividends.
Right.
They're not really, they pay their own taxes, but if you pay a dividend to your owner, that's a non-deductible to the company and tax to the individual. So that ends up being double taxed. Let me say this, you know, most cannabis companies are not profitable right now. And so many of them can be in a C corporation and never pay any double tax at all. And really the only tax that they would end up paying is the 280E phantom income tax at 21% at the corporate level. So that's a nice way to do it, rather than individual or larger corporation tax rates. Actually, they would still be 21%, but individual tax rates at say 35%, right? So it used to be that the tax burden was you know, counterproductive to being a C corp. Now that's not so much the case.
So we're speaking with Nick Richards, who is a partner in Greenspoon Martyr out of Denver, and he's a former IRS trial attorney. Nick, following that point, does the structure, it seems to like the structure can provide some protection. But if I'm a flow-through organization, does the 280E phantom income issue flow through into a LLC or a partnership?
It flows from an LLC or a partnership to whoever owns it. Mm-hmm. If I own an LLC, and that LLC, when it goes to report its tax liability, so long as it's not an LLC taxed as a C corporation, I don't want to get too tricky here, but generally they're not taxed as C corporations. But the net effect of that LLC's taxes shows up on my tax return on either a Schedule C or a Schedule E, and it either is gain or loss. And the thing that happens in the cannabis industry, you know, generally investors like to be investing in flow-through entities because they get flow-through losses that they can then use to offset their gains in other enterprises. In cannabis, because of Section 280E, phantom income, a real loss can be turned into a taxable gain really fast, right? And so because of that, there's a real learning curve here for the investors out there to understand that this is not their normal investment. It has a completely different effect, and they really want to be protected from flow-through phantom income. I don't know an investor out there that wants to invest money and then get flow-through, you know, income that he or she has to pay tax on, but that they never get, right?
Right. So phantom income. So if you were somebody walked in your office and said, Nick, I want to talk to you about buying a dispensary. Mm-hmm. How important is understanding this 280E section to that
critical
potential investor?
It's critical. You know, what happened is that 280E it was sort of a surprise to the industry. And even after it popped up, there were a lot of people out there saying, oh, it's not true, we'll prove them wrong. And so a lot of dispensaries didn't pay attention to 280E and didn't account for it properly. And now those dispensaries are out of business. It's that important that if you're not doing it right, you're not going to be in for the long term. As a matter of fact, I do a lot of lecturing all throughout the country. And when people come up to me and say, well, we're just going to see how it goes, I say to them, well, that sounds like about a 3-year plan to me. So
to be out of business in 3 years.
Yeah. Yeah, you'll be out of business in 3 years unless you take it.
So is just for my own information, and our listeners can listen in, is 280E part of the making marijuana a illegal drug, or was it in place before then?
It's part of the Making Marijuana Great Again movement. Section 280E. Section 280E was put into place in, now let me get my dates wrong here. I want to say it was 81, something like that. And it was part of the war on drugs.
Okay.
And it came from a case where in an illegal drug dealer, not a state legalized licensed dispenser or anything like that, an illegal drug dealer that was selling crack and meth and marijuana and everything else, got busted and then filed tax returns and claimed his expenses. So that included car mileage for delivering his products. That included scales and the price of the scales, his cell phone, his home. He claimed a home office because that's where he sold his marijuana and stuff like that. And so he went to the United States. The IRS says, no, you don't get that. You're in an illegal business. And for that reason, you don't get your deductions. Well, he went to court and won. And so he got his deductions. The U.S. Congress heard about that during the war on drugs, didn't like it, and passed Section 280E.
So if we get, if we do get some reform that that cannabis is no longer an illegal drug, would you expect 280E to go away?
280E will go away if they remove cannabis from one Schedule 1 or Schedule 2 of the Controlled Substances Act. So Section 280E says if you're trafficking in a Schedule 1 or Schedule 2 controlled substance, you don't get your deductions.
Yeah. Well, we could spend a lot more time talking to Nick about this particular subject, and we're going to have him back and talk about other tax issues. We've been speaking to Nick Richards from the firm of Greenspoon and Marker out of Denver. He's a former IRS trial attorney. Nick, thank you. And tell our audience how they can follow you and get information and talk to you.
Yeah, Dan, you can see me on gmlaw.com, which is my law firm. And if you Google my name, Nick Richards and cannabis tax, you'll see I'm probably lecturing in a city near you sometime soon. And I've been helping people in the industry for about 6 or 7 years now, and I've seen the miracles that the industry has done throughout our country, and I would love to talk to anybody that was interested.
Thank you so much for being on the conversation today, Nick.
Thank you, Dan. You have a great day.
Thank you. We'll be right back.
America's newest and fastest growing cannabis-focused radio network is expanding across the country and looking to add to our sales and marketing team. America's Cannabis Conversation offers listeners insight and information on the exploding world of cannabis. It also gives advertisers the opportunity to reach a hyper-targeted audience, literally neighborhood by neighborhood, in markets all across the country. We're looking for a few motivated individuals that want to essentially run their own local business in markets like Boston, Las Vegas, Reno, Orlando, and more. To learn more about this exciting opportunity or to apply, visit americascannabisconversation.com.
This is Dan Perkins, and we're about halfway through today's conversation. I hope you have found the people interesting and helpful. In case you didn't hear all of the interviews in today's conversation, you can go to W420RadioNetwork.com to listen to this show. If you missed any of our previous shows, or you want to hear a particular show again, you can go to the archives and download a missed show anytime that's convenient for you. Our goal is to bring a high-quality program that is both entertaining and informative. For those of you who are in the industry, we hope we can continue to be your voice, telling the people of America the benefits of this amazing all-natural product. We have been surprised at the willingness of important people to come into this new program and talk about the challenges and opportunities in the cannabis industry. It's hard to believe that it's been 23 years since cannabis was made legal in California. I think the next 23 years might be even more exciting than the first 23. One more thing before we get back to the conversation. Should you have a question or a comment, please contact us at contact@W420RadioNetwork.com. That's contact@W420RadioNetwork.com. And now, back to the conversation.
Welcome back to the conversation. Today we're going to talk about something new and innovative. We're talking with Justin Costello, who is the founder of GRN Funds and Holdings. And he's going to tell us about an exciting new technology that's going to save huge amounts of money for the cost of doing business in cannabis. And he's going to talk to us about his new venture of supplying drones for delivery. Justin, welcome to the conversation.
Good to be back. Thank you.
Justin, I want the audience to hear just exactly what it is you're doing in this exciting new space of drones.
Sure. Last year I was approached by a gentleman who was involved to some degree with the Amazon drone program, came to me and basically said, you know, I got something to show you. And I said, okay, well, that's great. You know, how do I do that? So we went back and forth. He was pretty, you know, quiet about it. He didn't want to really give me any information, any due diligence. So, you know, I didn't really take it as much seriously. And then he called me and said, hey, I need you to come to this this area, and I want to show you something. So, you know, he brought me to this area, and, you know, I pull up, and I knew he was in the drone business, so I had assumed it was going to be something to that degree. And he basically said, you know, watch this. And he pulled out a control mechanism and basically tied it. You know, there was a tote that basically attached to this large drone, and it went up, and we watched it through a camera system, you know, go, and he pushed a button, and it released this tote. And then he pushed another button, and it flew right back and landed 2 feet from me, all automatic. So he said, I think you could, you know, revolutionize delivery in your industry due to the high cost of security, the high cost of insurance, the high cost of delivery, really, at the end of the day. And I penciled the numbers, and then, you know, I looked at it, and I said, wow, this is a 90% cost savings, you know. And so then we looked at the legal aspect of things with the FAA and everything like that, and spoke to our attorneys. And, you know, my attorneys were like, well, own the technology, right? Own the drones, license the drones out, let the operators deal with the policy or the political side of things. Don't get involved in that. That's what we're doing. We basically took an interest. We signed a purchase agreement, and we've got, you know, these drones that are being delivered to us in March, which I'm very excited about. They're heavier duty drones, which basically are heavy payload drones, and they're used in search and rescue. So they're a technology that's been involved in law enforcement, search and rescue, and to that nature. So yeah, so we basically kind of customized a large scale drone for our industry. It has it's going to be outfitted with an iPad that has a closed loop payment system on it. It also has, you know, GPS tracking. It has camera systems. It has a tote based system that can hold up to 3 totes and deliver up to 40 kilograms on those totes. So, you know, we're going to start light duty as well. You know, no one wants to see them get shot out of the sky or anything like that, or to that degree. But they're you know, from a security perspective, they're a lot safer. You don't have to spend $1,000 on a delivery, and it's more efficient and quicker. So kind of looked at it and said, it's kind of a no-brainer.
Justin, when we first talked about coming on the show, you talked to me about the cost savings of this drone technology and what it could mean to people in the cannabis industry. Would you share that so our listeners can understand just how dynamic this new technology is? What does it cost to deliver? How do you break down the costs?
Well, usually you have to, you know, you don't want to have somebody who's a cut rate employee delivering, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars of cannabis products. You know, so you're going to pay them pretty well. You also have to have a sprinter. A sprinter can cost anywhere from $20,000 up to $100,000, depending on the type of sprinter you have.
Excuse me for interrupting, but not everybody might know what a sprinter is, but it's basically a truck, a panel truck.
That's right, and you have to customize it with an alarm system. You have to customize it with usually a cage that will, you know, hold the product in there. And, you know, then you also have to consider things like robberies, and that happens in this industry. But really, at the end of the day, we didn't look at it as trying to change policy or coming out the newest, coolest thing. We looked at the fundamentals of what this could save the industry. And also, you know, because of the nature of the business, the insurance cost can be anywhere from 3 to 10 times more than an average commercial vehicle because of the nature of the business, because it's cannabis. So we knew all this because we've been around the transportation side of the business. We've worked with it. And I said, well, you know, a drone, you have your one cost to purchase the drone. You do have to calibrate it from time to time. But it, you know, it's based on a battery system, and it's, you know, a system can be flown by an operator that's based anywhere, really, at the end of the day. So yeah, we looked at that as what we wanted to do, and we figured out while we could save the industry a whole lot of money, and that's one of the big pieces or the big cost of goods and services is transportation and delivery of the product.
So are you saying you're in the business of franchising or owning?
Yeah, we're going to own the technology. We're going to own the drones, and then as for licensing them off. Every state's going to be a little different on how that's done, so we'll have to take it on a state-by-state basis.
So, Justin, is your company going to build the drones?
They're already being built, yeah. The we bought the technology and the IP from the builder, and then the builder is becoming part of our company. That's the deal that we struck. And then as for, like, the operators or, you know, the people that are actually, you know, wanting to use them or franchise them or license them, however you want to call it, that will usually be either the producer processors or that'll be a transportation company. So that we figured that's the best way to not put ourselves in harm's way with, you know, regulatory entities and the FAA and all that.
We're speaking with Justin Costella, who's the chairman and founder of GRN Funds and Holdings, about his technology of using drones to make cannabis deliveries. How scalable is this business?
I mean, we see it as very scalable. You know, at the end of the day, there's really no reason why someone would want to spend extra money and take extra time to deliver it in a van if you can load up your tote, have the drone come pick it up, and pay for it, and get it dropped in, you know, 15 to 20 minutes. It's just kind of it's a no-brainer from a cost savings perspective. And I think that's something that the industry now is taking a hard look at, because things are getting more competitive. They're looking at return on investment of CapEx. And there's no better way to save money than to cut down on your transportation costs. In any logistics-based business, that's one of the highest percentage of things that you try to cut costs on. So, yeah, that's what we really kind of dug into. And we looked at, you know, we're finance guys. So we looked at the fundamentals. We looked at the cost savings. And, you know, nobody wants to be first in anything, right? But in this case, right, we see such a big hole and it's such a big cost savings perspective on this technology that we just had to do it.
Do you have any competitors to your technology at the moment in the cannabis space?
No, we don't probably foresee too many of the competitors. I mean, there's been people that have tried to do this in other industries. You know, it's very challenging to go to an industry if you're not in the industry and try to do something like this. I mean, we're industry people. We understand that this is kind of a niche type area. We didn't need to spend, you know, a year doing due diligence and doing a pro forma business plan, because we already kind of knew what the costs are on the other side. So we just used whatever data that we had existing and pulled from it. And then we put it against this and said, wow, you know, if we can save somebody 90% a year on, say, it's $250,000 in delivery cost for your business, you know, why wouldn't they do it? So that's the main reason that we did. We think it's cool. We think it's super cool, but and we're excited about how cool it is. But but at the end of the day, I think if you want something that's going to be a market disruptor, it's got to hit all the different areas of market disruption. And the main one usually is cost savings.
So when you look at the business model, can a van, a Sprinter, carry a lot more weight tonnage than a drone?
Yeah, sure it can, but it also takes, you know, five times as long to deliver. It's expensive from a fuel cost perspective. I believe that people in this industry as well are environmentally conscious, so we're removing a carbon footprint as well as creating cost savings. And we can be more frequent with our deliveries. So things like vendor managed inventory and just-in-time inventory, you know, things that are not new to, you know, average business, but it's new to the cannabis business. So, you know, why would you want to get a huge, you know, 10 boxes of inventory when you can get it once or twice a week and it's what you need for the week? So your cost savings on that as well from your inventory.
I hadn't thought about that, but just-in-time delivery really also cuts down on the inventory of the warehouse and the retail store and get fresher product to the customers. In our pre-show interview, you talked about how you were going to monetize this business. What are your plans for expansion and growth?
Well, we're starting here in March. We're doing. We've already got some retailers and some producer processors that are signed up and want to go. So we're starting it here. We plan on hitting areas like California, Illinois, Florida, and some of the bigger states that it makes sense to go to. So, you know, we don't have a number of how many drones we're going to be flying in 2022 or 2023. We'll really let the market kind of demand that. But we're seeing a lot of interest, and we're seeing a lot of demand. And people do realize how expensive, delivering this type of product is. And I think people are saying, wow, if this really can save us that kind of money, you know, we really want to do it. And it's kind of a unique way to deliver, too.
Justin, do you have this product or any information about this product on your website?
The company's name is Squadrone. The non-binding LOI is on there. There's a little bit of information. We're very careful about the IP and releasing the IP because it's very proprietary, and obviously right. We spent a lot of money to purchase it. So we've been right. We're in process of purchasing it, so we're very careful of that.
So can people go to the website today and get a basic understanding of what it is you're trying to do?
It's right on our site. It's on the grnholding.com site. It should be right on there, and I believe the other site is squad-drone.com or squadrone.com. So I'll have to double-check on the actual domain. We're just finishing that up as well.
We've been speaking to Justin Costello, the chairman and CEO of GRN Holdings and Funds, about his new technology of using drones to deliver. Thank you for joining us today, Justin. And if you missed any portion of this terrific interview with Justin, you can go to W420RadioNetwork.com and listen to this show and previous shows. I'm Dan Perkins.
You're listening to America's Cannabis Conversation on the W420 Radio Network.
Welcome back to the conversation. Joining us today is Morgan Fox, the Communications Director for the National Cannabis Industry Association. Welcome, Morgan.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. I've asked Morgan to talk about the political process going on with so many of the Democratic candidates who were on the list, who have come off the list, but some still there, who want to take away any restrictions on opioids and other narcotics and make them just unregulated. And I'm curious how you think, as an industry, that position, that political position, is playing in the flyover states.
Well, I think I should mention two things first. The first being that NCIA doesn't take any position on any drugs not related to cannabis. And the second being that I haven't heard any of the presidential candidates saying that they want all drugs legalized without any sort of regulation. The plans that I've heard so far are either decriminalization, which doesn't necessarily remove any sort of penalty, but it removes any sort of criminal penalties for simple possession of these substances, but would make distribution and various unregulated selling still would remain illegal. And the other is actually regulating these substances similarly to alcohol or certain pharmaceutical medications. I think that it kind of varies depending on the substance for each person's plan. So I don't think anybody is saying no rules whatsoever and a total free-for-all. That being said, I think that even having a discussion about drugs other than cannabis is something that, the younger generation is very much prepared to have that conversation. And I think that people working in harm reduction have been making excellent points for years about how, as is the case with cannabis, regulation generally tends to make these substances safer for consumers and remove a lot of the problems caused by using a criminal justice paradigm in order to deal with them in our society. You know, I think that for maybe some older voters, and I haven't seen the polls on this yet, but I'm sure that they'll be out at some point in the near future, that might be a step too far. And there's still a lot of stigmatization around consumers of illicit drugs that is going to be hard to shake from a lot of the electorate. But that being said, I think if we're looking at the larger political spectrum right now and the way that politics are playing out, there may be a viable move for, having bold policy positions.
Morgan, one of the reasons we founded this show is that we know, based on conversations and research, that a lot of people in this country know very little about cannabis and think of it in terms of because of the way it's been attacked by
various administrations and politicians that it's the same category as opioids and narcotics. In reality, it's not. So we felt an important opportunity to have discussions with people like you to educate people about what's going on. But I'm wondering if the baby isn't being thrown out with the bathwater when it comes time that the rhetoric has dirtied the water and made cannabis in the same category in many people's minds as opioids or narcotics.
Well, I think that the American electorate is pretty educated about the relative safety of cannabis, especially when compared to a lot of other drugs, both legal and illicit. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it really should be treated in its own category because of the relative nature of it. But that's not to say that a lot of the same principles that are being applied to cannabis policy reform aren't also applicable to other substances and other substance use patterns. However, I think that that is going to take a significant amount of voter education to get people to that point and get them to see that, you know, yes, clearly cannabis is safer than a lot of these other substances. But that's not to say we shouldn't treat these other substances in something other than a criminal justice paradigm. But like I said, I think it's going to take a lot more voter education on the part of candidates as well as on the part of activists and harm reduction workers.
We talked in your last appearance, we talked about the DEA and their miscount of 29 billion tablets on opioids to 100 billion in a 10-year period, not counting the stuff that comes across the border, and 160-some thousand people who died from overdoses of this product. It seems to me, and I could be wrong, that the public is about as ignorant about opioids as they are about cannabis, maybe even more. And I'm curious, as when you talk about education, what do we have to do, your organization and my network, what do we have to do to help break the ignorance cycle and begin a process of even more education? What should we be doing?
Well, I think that the process regarding cannabis for that has already been well underway for a number of years now, thanks to the ability to disseminate information much more quickly via the internet and various social media avenues. And I think that it's important to continue that, as well as for anybody that has the ability to continue funding more research and to really get involved in both grassroots as well as larger national politics in order to share the information that they have with everybody from voters to public servants to lawmakers.
Do you think that the general election in November, that cannabis, opioids, and other drugs will be a major campaign issue?
Well, I think that cannabis policy will continue to come up, but in all the research that we've done shows that it's still consistently not a top 10 priority issue for most voters and therefore not for most politicians, although it's been great to see how many of the candidates have been really vocal when it comes to this issue. Whether or not it'll be a major issue that's frequently brought up in debates as it goes forward, or whether it will be an issue past the primaries in the general election, I think remains to be seen. I'm positive that it's going to come up and it's going to keep coming up, but whether it is something that massively influences the electorate, I think that that's probably going a little bit too far. It will certainly affect some voters' decision-making, in terms of the entire electorate, I think that it'll probably have a little bit less of an impact than one might think. But you know, that really it doesn't matter from our perspective. You know, just keeping the conversation going and the fact that we're starting to come to a consensus on both sides of the aisle is really what's important.
We're speaking with Morgan Fox, the communications director for the National Cannabis Industry Association. One follow-up question there, Morgan, is where is the administration? Where is the Trump administration on cannabis?
So we haven't really seen a whole lot of action there. Again, I think that this is probably a low-priority issue for the administration. But last year we saw him voice tentative support for the States Act. And on the campaign trail, the president said that several times that he supported states' abilities to do what they wanted when it comes to cannabis policy. And so I think that at the very least, we have some tepid support to stand on there. And, you know, we also did not see any sort of directives come from the administration to crack down on state legal cannabis businesses, despite the recension of the Cole memo in 2018. So I think that those factors combined mean that we're probably in an okay place with the administration, and it would really depend on the legislation that makes it to his desk. And if there are any sort of political issues involved with that, you know, with, you know, who's sponsoring the bill, et cetera, et cetera. But fairly confident that if anything is passed by both chambers, that it has a good chance of getting signed into law. But he clearly hasn't been as vocal on the issue as some of the Democratic candidates.
Right. So in the moments we have left, you and I've talked about the taxation of public dispensaries from the state level of being almost punitive in driving people to the black market. Yet in the last month, we saw in California two very significant raids on the illegal shops. What do you have any idea what changed in California that they decided to go after these shops?
I don't have any direct knowledge about what is informing the various enforcement decisions in California. You know, I think that unfortunately California is somewhat of a unique case because of its relatively unregulated medical system prior to the passage of Amendment 64, that or Prop 64, and the incredibly high barriers that the state has set for allowing businesses to get licensed. California is one pretty much the only place that still has unlicensed storefronts. So there is a lot of discussion about whether that should be dealt with via enforcement or whether that should be dealt with by lowering the barriers of entry and helping these people get licensed, because especially if they've been in operation for years. You know, I think that there's still a lot of debate around that. And obviously we don't want people going to jail. But at the same time, we have to make sure that consumers are getting regulated products, and we have to watch out for unscrupulous actors. So, you know, I think that it's could be considered legitimate. In terms of, you know, what we're looking forward to seeing in the future, I think that that also remains up in the air. And, you know, recently some bills were introduced to lower the tax rates for cannabis businesses in California to help them get on par and help displace the illicit market. So hopefully that will make it easier for people to get licensed and to stay viable in those markets.
What do you think about the momentum in general of the cannabis business?
Oh, I think that, you know, it's growing very well, and especially as more and more markets are being opened up in different states. We're looking at a number of states considering ballot initiatives and legislations this year that will create a significant amount of change, raise the number of states to a level where there'll be even more support in Congress, and open up a lot of new markets for the business to businesses to start to enter and flourish, as well as developing homegrown businesses. So, you know, I think that things are pretty well apace. Despite some recent issues in publicly traded companies and issues with some of the bigger companies having to cut staff, I think that that can really be traced to investors not really understanding that this is a long game and not something that they should expect immediate profit from.
Very well said. We've been speaking with Morgan Fox, the communications director for the National Cannabis Industry Association. Morgan, how can people follow you?
We're at thecannabisindustry.org, and you can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
Thank you for joining us today, Morgan. And if you missed any part of this interview or you want to hear previous interviews that Morgan's been on, and there are a lot, go to W420RadioNetwork.com archive section and download and listen to previous shows. Morgan, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Dan.
This is Dan Perkins, and thank you for joining the conversation. We hope you enjoyed the conversation today and invite you to join us next week. By the way, you can go to our website, www.americascannabisconversation, and download previous shows, but also on the website, you'll be able to see who our guests are going to be next week. So go to the website, americascannabisconversation.com, Download shows and look who's going to be on next week. This is Dan Perkins, and thanks for joining the conversation.
Thank you for taking part in America's Cannabis Conversation. To hear this show in its entirety or to hear any of our archive shows, log on to americascannabisconversation.com and tune in next Saturday at 4:20 p.m. for the next installment of America's Cannabis Conversation.